Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
My name is Maria Salamanca. I am a partner at Ashoka Ventures, a fund that kind of sits in a very unique part of the venture ecosystem focused on immigrant founders. And so we are kind of the earliest stage you can get, which is pre-seed, try to be the first check-in and support teams that have at least one former founder with a combination of services that include obviously access to capital, access to a supportive network and mentorship, and access to immigration support, since many of them need to navigate the very complex immigration system in the US. And so that's a little bit of what I do. I actually was born in Colombia, in Bogota, came to the United States when I was 7 years old, moved to Florida, where a lot of Colombians end up kind of moving to, and grew up in Orlando, Florida, very kind of suburban, middle of, I guess it's a very touristy place as well. So it's a very interesting place to grow up, where, you know, my parents were blue collar workers and my job was to be a good student. So it's kind of what I tried to do to my best, the best of my ability, and headed off to college at Berkeley, which is where I kind of first landed in California. The first time I ever got to California was for my first kind of orientation day for Berkeley. So I had already taken the written down and committed to Berkeley, but I'd never been. So was really, really excited and just fell in love with all things policy, tech, venture, just like the growing ecosystem of what happened in California and what was happening at the time. So kind of, you know, why redirected my career towards all things tech and venture.
Well, that's super exciting. And thanks for making time to talk to us on Ivy Podcast. That's pretty cool. I love the backstory, and you can relate on so many levels, being an immigrant myself from Kazakhstan, coming to US at a very young age. And a lot of things that I do these days after, you know, I've launched, operated many startups on my own as a founder operator, you know, successfully failed a lot of them. I had one decent outcome, but in general, utilizing that experience, one of my passions these days is through angel investing, is try to educate kind of the next generation of the immigrant angel investors that, you know, within my circles, the folks that, you know, from similar backgrounds as former operators transitioning to the other side of kind of the advisors and investors. So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about that with you, with the kind of the thesis that you guys have with Unshackled, focusing on the immigrant founders as well. So tell me a little bit more about that. Why, you know, I can make some calculated, I guess, assumptions from a standpoint of why the focus on the immigrants and things like that. But share with us, what's the premise behind this? How did that all come about?
Yeah, so the two founding partners, which now include me, I was the first kind of hire on the investment side after the two of them started. And I joined maybe one or two investments into the fund. So was really there for the full journey now, 6 years of you know, the fund is about 6.5-7 years old. So I think for them, they saw an opportunity to tap into a market that, you know, in general, Silicon Valley tends to be very entrepreneurial on the immigrant side, like, and historically the United States, right? Like immigrants tend to be entrepreneurial, not just on the tech side, but small business as well. So the brick and mortars of the world. So at any given point, if you look at the statistics on Fortune 500 companies, as well as what we call unicorn tech companies, those valued at over $1 billion. And you look at the founding teams, usually any given year, anywhere between 40 to 50% of those companies were founded by an immigrant founder. And so obviously we know that immigrants are not 40 to 50% of the US population. And what that means is that this is a community that over-indexes in entrepreneurship. And more than not, a very successful entrepreneurship. And so the idea behind the fund was, let's double down on a population that is doing this like right and well and at a very large percentage compared to kind of just broadening the scope. But I think uniquely also was around what are some of the barriers that kind of maybe prevent this population moving as quickly or innovating as quickly as they otherwise would? And immigration tends to be one of those. And so obviously there's a lot of folks that come here to study in the United States, really great schools, PhD programs, I'm sure know. A lot of folks that come because of work, right? They used to work at a Google in some other country and they get transferred over here and they want to stay here and they want to start a company here, but it's really hard because they're usually visa bound to their employer. And so we knew that this was something that was a very big friction point and barrier at the early days of what would be company formation for the founders. And so if we created a fund that it would support and alleviate this problem by having an in-house immigration council that would help them navigate this, then hopefully we could get them to succeed faster, to take the plunge faster, to really be less concerned about things that we could help support them with and they didn't have to worry about.
Well, that's super interesting. And I love that, you know, along with not just the financial side of the investment support that you do provide from the immigration standpoint, because, you know, I remember those days very early when first coming to US, it was a big challenge. And at the same time, it's a very complicated space to navigate on your own. So having that type of assistance, I think that's tremendous, especially for a lot of the founders that building companies and they also have to navigate that side of the spectrum. I think that's super cool. So, you know, you've been with the company for, you mentioned 6 years since its inception. Describe your typical day on the job. It's in terms of what do you spend most of your time on? And does that coincide with what you actually want to spend your time on?
Well, I feel like there's no one typical day, but in general, the role has a couple of buckets. One is finding good companies, which we call sourcing. So, you know, being at the places where founders are, many times university events, panels, judging, different community events. That's one component. The second component is all things like deal management, right? Like moving a deal through the pipeline of initial points of conversation to more evaluation, to more deeper conversations, diligence, reference calls, all that. Then the other one is more on after we have invested in a company, a lot of our time ends up being in supporting these companies. So whether it's helping them close a new candidate that they're really trying to hire, whether we're thinking about how they fundraise their next following rounds after us, just internal, you know, company building strategy, milestones, just kind of being a thought partner for these founders is I think, you know, the later you are in your venture career, the more time you spend on that. So it you know, probably starts being one third of your day to day and early in your career in venture. And by the time that you're a partner, it is more closer to like 50% or more in all things portfolio support. And then ultimately, obviously, once you get to a stage where you are part of the fundraising process as a partner, there's a good amount of time that you spend every couple of years in raising the actual fund. So that means talking to pension funds, endowments, institutional investors, wealthy families, and family offices to kind of give the fund investment capital so that we can also invest it. So kind of like the four buckets. And I think at any given week, any given month, I'm doing like, it fluctuates. There's times when, you know, obviously when COVID hit, I would say 75% of the time went onto portfolio support because every company was trying to figure out what does COVID mean for us? How do we adjust to the new times? Like, how do we extend runway? Because we don't know when capital is going to be available again. And then other times, you know, our portfolio is doing great. None of them are raising. All of them are, you know, hired great people or like heads down building. And so that means that most of our time goes to like finding new companies that we want to invest in and start supporting again. So it's very cyclical, but no day is the same for sure.
Right. No, that makes sense. What do you enjoy the most through these categories?
Oh, gosh. I actually really do enjoy working with companies. I think it's a way to, yeah, I think you can have a thesis on the space and where the space is going and how things work and who, you know, who you're selling to, whatever, and you know, find one or two companies that you want to, that you think are solving that problem correctly and make it better in it. But that's just a thesis. Like the real learning happens when you're like in the grind with the founders and they're trying to sell to those customers and it's not working. And then you're like, what happened here? I thought this was the right customer. I thought this was the right segment. And so you learn so much more from just the actual process of the company growing and you growing with them that that's really, I feel like where most of the real work and knowledge comes from, which is just being in there with your founders.
Right. No, that makes perfect sense. When it comes to, you know, as you go through that initial stage of sourcing and identifying deals, working on your deal flow, you spend a lot of time, you know, with the founders, with the founding teams. Tell us a little bit more about your process that really helps you kind of look at those very early indicators when it comes to founders or founder market fit, so to say, that makes you feel like, okay, this is the kind of, this has the right ingredients, this has all the right components for me to move forward to continue the dialogue with that particular founder. What are some of the characteristics that really help you identify those initially?
You know, we invest fairly early, which means majority of our companies are pre-revenue, many times like pretty early in their product. So there's not a lot of financial metrics or a balance sheet or sale number, like nothing to really go off of, which means that we ultimately are making a bet on, you know, 75% team, 25% kind of market product space. And so a lot of our time on the evaluation process and conversations with the teams is understanding them. The things that we look for is, you know, how quickly do they learn? What are their frameworks for prioritizing? What are kind of their own red flags of when it means that it's time to pivot? You just their ability to like learn quickly from everything else. There's that coachability aspect, which is someone I want to work with, right? Ideally, you work with these founders 5 to 10 years. And so there is a degree of like, do I like this person? Do I think that we could work together? Do I think that we could be good partners together? There's a lot around just unique advantage, right? Like if you know, most of the problems are obvious, a lot of ideas occur from different people. And so if the idea is not different, what really is different is kind of the execution. And so asking the question, why this team, particularly why them, why now? Right. And so some unique advantage that they have or wedge, whether it's on the business side, sales, actual core IP tech that they're building, that we think, you know, if there's any team that's going to build this, it's going to be, you know, this guy whose PhD just happened to be focused on this. And he's the only PhD in the country that does this. That there's a degree to focusing on and why then. And then ultimately we do take a bet, which I think is a little bit harder to make every time on the space and kind of inflection points and where this goes. You know, most of the companies we invest in will pivot realistically from the time we make an investment to like Series B. They're many more often than not a totally different company. And so we know that the market will kind of pull the best founders in the right direction. And so we are not too like focused on like this founder has to be doing this market, but we have to see that they're problem solvers, that they just like to figure it out.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. And it's, you know, at the end of the day, being, I like the concept of being a friend to a founder versus being a parent. And like you've mentioned, just overall, how, you know, how well do you get along with that particular individual? Because it's, you were right, you're going to be attached to the hip for the next 10 years. And can we work together? Can we have an honest conversation with each other when, you know, when things are not going well? So I think those are very unique perspectives. And it's also, for me, it's interesting to look at almost like these digital breadcrumbs of the founder, looking at the very early days of what they've done, let's say in college. You know, did you build a club or did you join the club? So those things are kind of always very interesting to get to know. You've mentioned you guys invest, you know, very early, even pre-revenue, and obviously a lot of decisions being made on the founder, kind of their fit and maybe their background. What are other components that you pay attention to when you make a decision to back that particular founder so early, when they probably don't even have, you know, any traction with the customers, or even maybe you mentioned not even the product? What are other important things that you pay attention to?
I think we try to get a sense of how much work they have done or are going to do before they start like writing a line of code or trying to sell, because we think that kind of pre-homework is really what differentiates like success. Like once you start hiring people, writing code, shipping products, trying to sell, you're going to start burning a lot of cash really quickly. And it's much more expensive to learn things like, is this the right customer segment? Are they like, what, how much are they willing to pay? Which a lot of this you could do just by a lot of just what we call customer discovery, like go out there, talk to different types of customers, big, small, figure out who inside an organization, if you're talking to an enterprise, is the right sales point, right? Are you selling to the head of sales? Are you selling to the head of engineering? Are you selling to the head of product? Are you selling directly to CFOs and within companies who are making the purchasing decision? So a lot of that you can kind of figure out before you ever have a product to show. And it just requires a lot of like very tedious customer discovery work to understand like, is this a problem we're solving? Is there money to be made here? And so we spend a lot of time just asking them on like, what have you learned so far? Like, what is your customer segmentation map look like? What are you prioritizing before the others? And kind of what have those conversations look like? Just to get a sense, I think there's no right answer at that stage. We know that even when you have a product and you go to sell it, it could change, right? People could love it. People could hate it. Even those that told you they wanted to buy. But we want to know some, like, just what are their mental frameworks for prioritizing and, like, moving through some of these problem questions.
Right. No, I love these concepts. When we talk about the overall, you know, value add investor, it's different sentiments. If you talk to different sides of the spectrum, I guess to the founders and entrepreneurs, and then if you talk to investors, you know, different perspectives in terms of the value add investor, so to say. What are your thoughts on that? Because, you know, I've been on both sides of the equation. I'm sure you've been as well. And for me, it was always the aspect of not so much what does that investor bring to the table? But for me as the operator, what type of value can I derive from that myself? That in a sense, I should not be expecting the investor to come to me with some of the, I guess, those value add activities. It's more on me as an operator to derive that. Share with us your thoughts on the overall concept, overall, you know, just a value add investor.
Yeah, well, everyone has a totally different take on this. I'll give you mine. I think there's investors who really, like, you know, the way I think of it is my job as an investor is to take advantage of like my viewpoint, which is like the macro viewpoint, right? I see a variety of companies building at the exact same time in very different markets. And so there's like macro insights that I can give around like good time to sell into this, bad time to sell into this. Like the market is moving really quickly now. The market's slowing down. Like we need to, you know, conserve burn. We need to double down on burn. Those are things that I can provide my founders that they can't provide each other because, you know, they're in the weeds, they're building. That's not their job to be that macro. The other thing is, you know, I get to see how different founders tackle problems, right? Whether it's go to market, whether it's how they thought about hiring the first head of product, how they thought about hiring the first salesperson. And so, you know, as a founder, you do that once, maybe you're the second company, you've done it twice. So you don't have the amount of reps that I would see based on, you know, we have 60 plus portfolio companies. And so my job is to provide that perspective on like, this is what has worked, what hasn't worked, and have some understanding of, you know, just because it was like that 10 years ago when you first did it in your first company doesn't mean it's like that today. I think the area where I really try to hold back from, and some of the best investors that were operators before do a good job at this, is, you know, we're no expert in the market the way that people in it every day are. And it's wrong for us to try to be that on like thinking of the idea ourselves or telling you what's the best approach for like not that market, another market. Like we're here to be like your thought partner, but not to tell you how to run your company. And so, you know, just because some investor was a previous exit, you know, CEO, you know, they've done it once and they did it in the last 10 years. So that doesn't mean that their information is most relevant today. Maybe some of them have created really great frameworks. They've helped, they've done angel investors. So they have some more macro view than not, but I think it's about leveraging what the strengths are. But you know, we try to be pretty humble. Like the founder knows the space and the product and the customer way better than we ever will. But like our job is to bring the macro view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very interesting perspective on probably a topic we could spend the rest of the podcast talking about this. But yeah, thanks for sharing kind of your thoughts around that. With a great deal flow and so many startups and founders probably pitching you on daily basis, it could be overwhelming in the sense of the volume. How do you ensure that the quality of the deal flow is there versus the quantity? Because at the end of the day, you probably look at, hundreds, if not thousands of, submissions or the pitches and referrals and introductions. What are some of the things that really help you identify from that very, 5 to 10 second glance that, yes, this is something that I want to take a little bit further. Share with us any of the frameworks or any tips that really help you succeed from that standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it comes from reps, right? So not just like seeing a bunch of deals, but it comes from seeing a bunch of deals that you decided to make a couple bets on, and then you're seeing those founders kind of execute on that and either survive or not survive. And so you start to see there's things you start looking for at the earliest stages, which is, maybe nuance and understanding the space. Maybe it's like speed to learning, something like that, where you start, it's a continuous feedback loop. And so obviously, the better your portfolio is, the higher your standards are for what investments come in. I think when you start fresh, first time investors, first time fund, I think you take a bet on people that you believe could be good, but it's going to be a while before you find out if it's right. And so I think obviously when you look at the deck, so you get a blurb and a deck to begin with, things that I look for obviously is kind of understand like why this team for this problem, broadly speaking problem, or broadly speaking market, and seeing if this is like, if they came together as a pretty good team. Like, I feel like they could solve a problem in a broad term here. That usually gets them a meeting. So team is really helpful. I think when the deck shows that they have done some work on customer discovery, right? Like kind of done some customer segmentation, understand who they're selling to first, second, third. When I mean we have a strong bias towards really scrappy and kind of capital efficient founders, so those that are like are not burning a lot of cash yet as they figure things out, and then founders like are clear to like what the money's going for, like what are the pending kind of thesis, like hypothesis that they're trying to prove and answer over the next 12 to 18 months. And so having those kind of questions answered in a deck is pretty impressive. If not, it's something that we try to get out of them anyway during the conversation. And the best founders tend to have good answers for that. And so, but yeah, I mean it's a I think that how pretty the deck is doesn't really matter. I think it's more about answering questions in a very nuanced way, but also having some depth where it's not just like very broadly defined problems.
Right, absolutely. No, I love that you mentioned, essentially it comes to the reps and being able to build that almost the process around identifying those data points that I covered in the deck and being able to take that and decide what to do next with that. That's pretty interesting. What are some of the trends and ideas that really excite you these days? What are you very passionate about researching extensively? What's in Maria's book of the next big thing?
Oh man, I've leaned a lot more consumer in the past couple of years. So, obviously, like the Facebooks of the world are quickly declining. Not a lot of young folks are using them anymore, which means that they're going to start flocking to other platforms. I think Snapchat and TikTok are kind of owning the space. But I think there is room for new players. To really become new social media, new social networks. It's going to look different, probably in the form of like gaming. So I think Roblox is a great example. Like folks think of Roblox as like a game itself, but it's actually closer to more of a social network than not. So I think that's exciting. All things kind of future of work. So how folks monetize on their talents and skill sets, whether it's credentialed or not, is definitely an area that I'm super interested in. Just the growth of people that kind of have side hustles and are like leaning hard into their creative skills or non-creative skills, but just like hustling. And just seeing how generational shifts will push people away from that and like from full-time jobs to maybe more just remote work or general flexibility in what they do is super interesting. And I think, you know, with that comes like a big demand of infrastructure and all things finance and healthcare. You know, if we're a little bit more independent of our employer when it comes to money and healthcare, then there's probably some big opportunity in having more independent platforms become the healthcare provider or becoming kind of monetization strategies for the individual and consumer. And so I think all things kind of future work, consumer and fintech is pretty exciting right now.
Yeah, those are very interesting trends and absolutely couldn't agree more with you, especially with the current times and the current market conditions coming out of pandemic and so forth, that becomes even more elevated in the sense that you know, not only a trend, but something that we've been observing for the past couple of years. There's a lot of companies embracing that, building solutions around that. I think it's super cool and very exciting. When it comes to your personal self-actualizational learning resources, share with us what's your content diet is looking like. What do you consume on a daily basis to stay ahead, but also be very selective with so much information being thrown at us on a daily basis? How do you control that? How do you let, you know, your mind be exposed to something that you will find valuable?
Yeah, I don't do a lot of like traditional news consumption. I think the only ones that I read tend to be, I read Bloomberg every day, Axios or Prorata, Axios Markets, which are kind of more the newsletter. I read daily to kind of keep me up to date with what's going on. I think long forms, every so often, you know, The Atlantic and The New Yorker, I take a look at Wall Street Journal, but most of my like in-depth reading comes from newsletters written by like folks that are like, you know, in the depths of thinking about it. And so, you know, read a couple of newsletters focused on just product, a couple of newsletters focused on like the history of innovation. There's a new newsletter called Colossus that focuses on like going deep into one company and what made them great. There's just a couple of, I guess, like folks that write really well and analyze systems really well. And I enjoyed reading that. So there's a newsletter called Brain Food that tends to be on just like folks who kind of focus on consuming good, healthy type of information diet. And Brain Food is all about just how to lean into that. So that's a great one. But yeah, that's a little bit of what I read. It's mostly on newsletters. The one on all things innovation is called The Roots of Progress. And it's this guy kind of going down to like what is at the root of progress in all of history. And he takes like different perspectives of time, like industrial revolution, like agricultural revolution, all the way back to understand like what led to any type of progress. Mm-hmm.
No, that's super cool. Definitely for our listeners, we'll make those links available in the show notes. Is there, in terms of the book, I always ask that every guest at the very end, is there one that you always recommend to others and why is that? The reason I ask that because I, you know, I change mine all the time, but I love, you know, I just love sending books to a lot of my network and all that, if something that I found valuable. So I'm just curious if you have something like that.
Yeah. Oh man, there's so many great books. I think one book that I recently read called Thinking in Bets, and it kind of crystallized a lot of what I have considered being an investor, like tactics that have been successful. And I don't think I ever put a lot of kind of words or critical thinking frameworks to it, but I knew that, you know, in practice, that's kind of how it worked. But Thinking in Bets is a great book around how to make better decisions. Which is always kind of something you're thinking about as an investor, which is like, how do I know I'm making the right bets? Highly recommend it from a poker player, because obviously poker players are always thinking in bets. And so that one's one that I very recently read, and so highly, highly recommend.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm going to add that to a growing list of the books that that I want to read. Maria, can thank you enough for your time today. Very short and very insightful conversation. Learned quite a bit personally. What I love doing with a lot of the guests that I host on the podcast is do another recording in about a year or so and see how much of change transpired and revisit the conversation from a year ago and see, hey, here's what we talked about. Does that still apply? Does that still make sense? So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
I look forward to it as well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.